From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. If you're not ready for the weekend end just yet, we've got you covered. Don't just stand there, bust the move. If you want it, you got it. We'll talk about how dance moves go viral today, and we want to see your best moves. I'm serious. Our producers have started a video dance challenge. You can check it out right now on Twitter and Instagram with the hashtag OSTDanceOff, and you should join in. Take on the staff of GPB on Twitter, at OSTTalk, or post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. We might turn this Monday into an actually fun day after all. Well, George's success in the film industry has created a lot of winners. There's no denying that. But who are the losers? Some would say minority actors on the whole. If you look at the numbers, there are just not that many prominent roles for non-white characters. But that could change thanks to a bill that was passed in this session of the Georgia legislature. House Bill 1577 looks to diversify entertainment opportunities for Georgians of all backgrounds in the hope of creating new stars and maybe helping to revitalize the industry. That the production company Nina Holiday Entertainment led that effort, and actor and director Terry J. Vaughn is co-owner of Nina Holiday. She'll make her directorial debut next month with the movie Hashtag Digital Lives Matter. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning.
The name of your company is a combination of Nina Simone and Billie Holiday?
Yes, ma'am. When I met my producing partner, Cass Seeger's Beatles, we talked, we vibed, we had the same sensitivities, and when we decided that we were going to start a production company and what we should name it, you know, she was a huge fan of Nina Simone, and I was a huge fan of Billie Holiday, so we just merged the names of these two trailblazers to name our production company after.
And, you know, trailblazers who also paid a price for being among the first African-American superstars.
Yes, absolutely.
So what do you think, you know, when we talk about the lack of diversity in Hollywood, there are so many very thoughtful pieces trying to explain why it still exists,
right,
despite the, you know, the stardom even going back to Sidney Poitier or further.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of theories, and I wonder which one you think is right. Is it money talks and people think that white stars are more likely to bring in money? Which one do you think is correct?
I really think that the people that are in position to greenlight projects, to hire, and you know, stars are made. Stars are made by the opportunities given to them. If Jennifer Aniston, Julia Roberts, I mean, if they weren't given the roles that they were given, they wouldn't be the superstars that they are. So I think that the people that are in position to hire actors, actresses, and even people behind the camera are just, they go with people that they feel comfortable with. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these people are not black. They're mostly white people, mostly white men running these companies. And so they go with what they are familiar with, what they feel comfortable with. And I think that that's really what it is like they don't want to step out of their comfort zone and, you know, embrace someone else.
Have you encountered this in your journeys through Hollywood? I mean, you've been on a number of really successful projects, including the Steve Harvey Show, but other things as well. Have you had personal experience with this?
Absolutely. I recall going in for an audition once for a Mother. It was for a family sitcom, and I was going in for the role of the mother. And in the audition, I just remember a producer, white male, and he said, "Yeah, but can you read her with a little more sass and, you know, a little more of, put a little bit more of this into it," and he started rolling his neck around. I was like, it just felt so belittling to be in a room where you're already being judged, and you're standing there and you're doing your work and you've done your homework, and she's a mother, and what does me rolling my neck and snapping and being this caricature of what you think a black mother should be, what does that have to do with me being a mother? Because that's not how I am. So that's just one incident of how they see us.
That's literally the subject of I think it's a Funny or Die video. Or maybe some other parody video. That's literally what happens. That's how odd that is.
Yeah, it's real.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actress and director Terry J. Vaughn. We're talking about Georgia's role in diversifying the film and entertainment industry. So you really lobbied for this bill, and I want to make sure the audience understands what this bill does is it establishes a committee to study this, and they have until December to do so.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about the limitations of this bill, but I wonder first what your case, how you made your case to the legislature. How did you argue this?
Well, seeing that I live here in Atlanta now, I moved here almost 7 years ago. And when I came here, I still was, of course, acting, and we had our production company. And, you know, a lot of my peers were like, thought I was crazy for moving to Atlanta from L.A. They were like, oh, my God, you're going to miss out on this. Are you still going to work and blah, blah, blah. And so when I came here with the mindset of I really want to help Atlanta film industry to be taken seriously. That means the actors that are here, I want them to be looked at seriously. All the camera people and everybody, because I feel like if this city is looked at as a pliable place to get efficient talent behind the camera, in camera, then that's going to mean that that's going to be more opportunity still for me to continue to work, because it would be like I live in New York still. You know what I mean?
I do. I want to make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying. It sounds like what you're saying is that because there's such a lack of diversity in Hollywood and other places, that there's an opportunity for Georgia to make a name and by doing the exact opposite, by giving more opportunities to people who are non-white. Is that accurate?
Well, that didn't come into my mind yet when I first moved here. When I first moved here, it was just all about having this, having Atlanta looked at seriously. Because in the industry, I'll be honest, Atlanta is really looked at as the reality show world. And when I'm going out for auditions, and if they see that I live in Atlanta, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, if we want a reality show, we'll call on them. Mm-hmm. And that's really the reputation that Atlanta has as far as the people in film in L.A. And that's why when companies come here from L.A. and other places to film, they usually bring their own crew. They bring their own crew. They bring, you know, everything, all the pieces that they need, because they don't trust the people that live here, because the people that live here only shoot reality show. You know what I mean?
Right. I get you.
So that's where my heart was. My heart was really wanting to establish a serious place where the industry is looked at seriously in Atlanta, that you can come here and you don't have to bring your whole crew, and you can even hire talent here because they're on their P's and Q's just like the people in Atlanta, in Los Angeles. So once I got here and we were able to do several projects, and I was actually hired on some projects, but it was still behind the camera. There wasn't a lot of women, and there wasn't a lot of black people. And this is worldwide in the industry. That's how it is.
Yeah.
And I was like, this Atlanta is primed to be the one to take the stand to figure out the answer to this, because this is not a new, it's not a new issue in Hollywood. Like you said, you brought up from when Sidney Poitier was.
Yes, it's longstanding. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, every once in a while, there's a wave where everybody's talking about diversity is a problem, and diversity, and it's the high point, and then people in the industry, you know, tries to figure it out, and they start doing this, and they start giving a little bit more opportunities, but then it fades away. And this has been ongoing forever. So, you know, you just get that wave. There's a bunch of black productions going on, and then they go away. And then, it, you know. And so I was like, it needs to be something legitimate that sticks. So what we came up with is when these film industries come here, there's a lot of pieces that go into making a movie. There, you know, behind the camera, there's catering, there's dry cleaning, there's florists, there's carpenters, there's plumbers. There's a lot of things that go into building sets and all this stuff. There's companies here, minority-owned companies, women-owned companies, that already do this in their own industry and field, dry cleaning, flowers. So they're already experts at what they do. Now, how can we merge these companies to be the ones to operate within the movie industry when they're here? They're already experts at what they do. Now they just need the opportunity to work into the film industry, and that will allow minorities to get more work in the industry. So that was kind of our thought, because we had to think of something that would be realistic. It's like you just can't tell them to hire minorities and women just because they're lacking. They still have to be able to know what they're doing.
Right.
And so these are people that have their businesses, minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, that are already professionals in their own right. And now how do we merge that into them being included into the growing film industry here in Atlanta instead of them hiring outside of Georgia for that? So that, to me, was a easy fix, and that's kind of how we brought it to the Black Caucus. In helping in the diversity step. And that's just a step.
Right. And that's what I wanted to ask about is, what do you hope? Because, again, this is all that the bill did was establish a committee that will study it.
Exactly.
So what do you hope comes out of this committee?
Well, what we hope it will be more jobs for Georgians overall, because so many of the film industry jobs, they go to people outside of Georgia. But they're taking advantage of the tax incentive that is here in Georgia. So we think that if you you include another tax incentive, this is what we presented to the Black Caucus. If there's another tax incentive, a 5% tax incentive, if you hire a certain amount of minority or women percentage workers on set, and that's in front of the camera and behind the camera, if you reach this quota of, let's say, 25% of your staff is minority and women, then you can qualify for the extra 5% tax credit. And that way, it creates more jobs, and the industry can see that, oh, there are people in Atlanta that can work in this business. And it starts to build a trust factor in the industry, to where they don't feel like they have to bring in people from LA or New York to do the jobs that people here in Georgia are capable of doing as well.
And we'll see what happens after the committee. But it's partly due to the efforts of my guest, Terry J. Vaughn, actress and director. Her upcoming movie is called #DigitalLivesMatter. The film premieres next month at the American Black Film Festival. Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you so much. And I did want to say, for that movie, we made sure we hired everyone who worked on the film, #DigitalLivesMatter, in front of the camera and behind the camera, were Atlanta.
That's great.
Georgian.
Thank you so much. This is On Second Thought. The death of Eric Garner in 2014 was an unforgettable moment for many people. Garner died after New York City police officers placed him in what most would call a chokehold. The image of his death and his iconic last words were captured on video. Garner's words live on now through the music of one Atlanta artist. Eric Garner is one of several unarmed Black men killed by police whose last words are now included in a new composition. It's called Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. The song was written by Atlanta composer Joel Thompson, and the version we hear is a performance by the University of Michigan's Glee Club. Joel Thompson and one of the Glee Club members joined me this morning. Julian Goods is from the Chicagoland area. Good to have you and Joel here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to be here.
Julian, what is a glee club?
The glee club here and across university is our choirs designed for one gender. So here we have the men's glee club, which is all men, but we also have a women's glee club. And that's pretty standard across universities.
Yeah, I just want to, in interest of full disclosure, I got my degree from the University of Michigan Music School, and I just want to let everybody know I didn't pitch this story, so it wasn't influenced because of U of M, although go blue.
Go blue.
Joel, I wanted to talk about your motivation for the piece because I found it very interesting that Eugene Rogers, who's the professor of conducting at U of M School of Music, has said he chose your piece as part of teaching students Ubuntu, which most people associate with Nelson Mandela. It's a Bantu term that refers to a sort of a belief in the universal bond between all of humanity. And I wonder if that was also part of your process in writing.
Well, when I wrote the piece, it was really just, for me, it was a very personal endeavor. I wrote it to try and process my own feelings, and I really didn't intend to show it to anyone. But I came to realize that many of the barriers that exist between us, racism, sexism, and other boundaries are a result of people not being willing to have those experiences in which we step into other people's shoes and have a cultural dialogue. And I felt that the piece would be able to offer that opportunity to have a dialogue. And that fit perfectly with Dr. Rogers' sort of musical philosophy of Ubuntu and trying to get people to have conversations and share the pain and the hurt of either side and come to a common understanding.
I want to play a section of the song, and it's a multi-movement song.
Yes.
These are the last words of Kenneth Chamberlain. Chamberlain was a 68-year-old African-American man. He was a Marine veteran, killed in 2011 by police while he was inside his own home in White Plains, New York. How did you choose the last words that you were going to use for the piece?
Well, my partner, Dr. Emiko Soltis, she showed me these pictograms on Twitter by Iranian-American journalist and artist Shirin Bargi. And they depicted a very stark image paired with the last words and age of unarmed black men killed by police officers. And she suggested that there should be a musical version of these. And so I took the existing trope of the seven last words of Christ, commonly set liturgical words in the classical music idiom. And
let me translate what you just said for people who are not musicians. There's a whole bunch of different settings by different composers of the seven last words of Christ. And if you are in music, even if you're an instrumentalist and not a singer, you have played a version of the seven last words of Christ at some point in your career. Okay, pray continue.
And so I took the liturgical order and I found the last sayings that matched them sort of thematically. So, for example, the third last word of Christ was, "Mother, this is thy son. Son, this is thy mother," in reference to Mary and John, his disciple. And so that maternal connection, I took the last words of Amadou Diallo, "Mom, I'm going to college," and I put that as the third one. So it was, I used the structure of the classical piece to assemble seven last words of the unarmed.
Which brings us to you, Julian, because one of the things you had to do was not just sing, but your professor required you write essays about this piece, correct?
Yes, sort of. We got the opportunity, the university presented the opportunity for us to take this performance and turn it into a documentary. And so one of the things he asked is if you would like to have an interview that could potentially make it into the documentary, to write an essay, just a, you know, one page, you know, two paragraph, couple paragraphs, however many, on what this piece has meant to you and how you personally have come to grow with the piece over the course of the semester.
And what did you choose to write, I should ask first?
Yes, I did. I did, very much so. And I talked about my experience as an African-American male coming from Chicago and how, for me personally, the issues of gun violence and police brutality is something that I hear about every day. It's something you hear on the news. It's just like the weather. You know, the weather comes on and somebody else, you know, gets shot. And it's like today, you know, 32 people died. Tomorrow it's going to be 15. But, you know, a holiday's coming up. And so, you know, we estimate about 100 will be shot and 15 will be killed. And so I talked about that and how, for me, this was something I hear every day. So it was not something new. But for my colleagues who don't necessarily come from the same environment, this was not reality. It was something different. It was an eye-opening experience to say, wow, this really does happen, and how could this happen?
Let's hear a little bit more of the music that we're talking about. This is the last words of Oscar Grant, the part of the song that features that. Oscar Grant, his story was featured in a recent movie. He was unarmed when he was shot in 2009 during an encounter with police at an Oakland, California train stop. The clapping, is that the gunshot?
It's the reaction to the gunshot, sort of like clutching the chest. I wanted it to sort of conjure that exact moment of sort of incredulity, where you shot me, and then sort of accepting it, you shot me. It's one of the most powerful moments, I think, in the piece, because it's so raw and real, and it was probably one of the most difficult to write. I watched the video of his death from multiple angles, from cell phone videos at that BART station before writing that, and it was pretty tough.
For those who are in the choir, and I assume this is maybe who you were referring to, Julian, when you talked about your colleagues, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how this goes over with your colleagues who are white. Sometimes discussions of these kind of things can make people feel defensive or make people feel as though they're being blamed. And I wonder if there was any kind of discussion among the Glee Club about that.
Yes. So one of the, when Dr. Rogers presented this piece to us.
You're referring to Eugene Rogers, who's the director, the conductor of the Glee
yes,
Club.
Yes, our director. When he brought this piece to the group, one of the things he said is we want to keep this, we want to keep an open mind about it, and that he would not enforce any political views on it, and that this piece does not express any certain political view, but instead it is simply there to honor the lives of these victims. And so as a group, we collectively came to the agreement that no person should have to, one, lose their life at that young of an age, and two, lose it in this way. You know, no matter who here is at fault, we can collectively as a community agree that no matter what the circumstances were, this shouldn't have happened. This person shouldn't have to lose their lives. Mothers shouldn't, you know, have to hear last words of their child being, you know, mom, I'm going to college, and that dream not become a reality.
We've got about 2 minutes left, Joel, and I wonder, you said that you almost just wrote this for yourself. Why did you decide to release it publicly and have it performed?
I felt an itch. I felt that I had to do something about it. I, as an artist, sometimes you get you sort of think, what is the purpose of this? Am I actually doing something to help my community or help others? Sometimes you hear a beautiful chord and you think, like, what is the purpose of this other than to provide beauty to me or satisfaction to the people around me? But I felt that I had an opportunity to, with the art that I had made, to start a dialogue to express pain and have people, you know, express, you know, the good and the bad and sort of figure out what we can do to sort of change the pronoun that we use when trying to address this issue. A lady came up to me after a recent premiere and she said, what do we do about this now? And I was just so relieved that she used we instead of you or them. So I think that's, and once I heard that, I realized I made the right decision in sharing the piece, because now we're having these wonderful conversations that can hopefully lead to some substantive change.
That's Atlanta composer Joel Thompson. His song, Seven Last Words of the Unarmed, features the last words of unarmed Black men who've been killed. We have a link to that song at our website, gppnews.org. We also heard from University of Michigan Glee Club member Julian Goods. He's performed this piece. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's close with another part of that song, and this is featuring the words you've heard mentioned, "Mom, I'm going to college," reportedly said by Amadou Diallo, a 23-year-old immigrant from Guinea who was shot 41 times by New York City police in 1999. Police thought he was pulling out a gun. He was unarmed. Mordor, White Walkers, Darkseid, Terminus, Hufflepuff. If any of those words put you in a mood to talk nerdy, then you are probably a fan of fantasy fiction. The stereotype is you're a teenage boy or young man, probably white. But female fans are out there. I'm one of them, and so is Emily Jones in GPB Savannah. In fact, she is a diehard consumer of fantasy fiction, and she spends her Sundays like a lot of people do with the HBO series Game of Thrones. She has stuck with that show, even though she has pretty harsh words about its misogynistic treatment of female characters. Emily explains why it bothers her almost more than mistreatment of women in the real world.
The premiere episode of this season of Game of Thrones got a lot of praise for finally giving some wins to women. And it was well-deserved praise. After 5 seasons of rape and totally gratuitous female nudity, it felt great to watch a few women seize control of their fates and stab dudes who deserved it. But mostly, our latest trip to Westeros and the glut of cultural commentary that comes with it just renews my excitement for the next installment in one of my favorite fantasy book series. And no, I don't mean the long-awaited 6th book in the series Game of Thrones is based on. I'm talking about the Old Kingdom books by Garth Nix. Here's why. Women just aren't oppressed in that world. There's no real patriarchy. People ride around on horseback and live in castles. They fight with swords and magic, all the usual hallmarks of your standard fantasy lit. But Nix remembers this one key thing most fantasy authors seem to forget. They're making up this world. It's fantasy. So if the gender politics are terrible, it's because the author made the gender politics terrible. It's the most basic thing to me. If you're going to imagine a universe full of magic and dragons, you're clearly departing the reality that we live in. When you're willing to throw modern medicine and technology and even physics to the wind, why, of all things, do you have to cling to the gender norms of our real world? Winter can last years and dead bodies can return as creepy ice zombies, but somehow women are still primarily expected to be dutiful wives and mothers. What? Some fantasy authors do this on purpose, to give their female characters something to fight against. I'll admit, that can be really fun and empowering to watch. And Game of Thrones author George R.R. Martin explicitly says his series is based on our own Middle Ages, so this may be intentional for him to some degree. But not entirely, and I really doubt that it's an intentional choice for most authors. I think many have so thoroughly internalized our own gender politics that they don't even think to throw them out. So, a reminder to fantasy creators. As you ask yourself questions like, can my characters time travel, and should I use an undead army in this story? Maybe add a few questions about your female characters. Is there a good narrative reason to oppress the women in this story? Does everyone holding a sword have to be a man? The answer is probably no. like any good fan, I'm eagerly watching Game of Thrones this season, and I will devour the next book when it comes out. But what I'm really looking forward to is diving back into a series where the strong female protagonist battles all kinds of dangers and challenges, and none of them have anything to do with her gender.
Emily Jones is a reporter with GPB Savannah. What do you think about the way women are portrayed in science fiction and fantasy? Is there an author or show writer who gets it right, do you think? We want to hear from you. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought. Well, you might see dances like the Dougie and the Nay Nay, not just at festivals, but mainly in YouTube videos that come from all over the world. Many of these moves, though, you may not know it, have their roots in hip-hop in the South. Writer Rodney Carmichael dug into the history of some of these dances and why Atlanta is the viral dance capital. He is senior staff writer at Creative Loafing and co-host of the 5 Points podcast. It's always a pleasure to have you with us, Rodney.
Yeah, always a pleasure to be here, Celeste. Thank you.
And also with us is Rennie Harris. He is professor of hip-hop dance at UCLA and the University of Colorado at Boulder. Welcome to the program, Rennie.
Hey, how's it going?
Do you actually commute between UCLA and Boulder, Colorado?
I'm there, UCLA in the spring, Boulder, the fall.
Oh, okay. That's not as bad. I imagined you taking that flight all the time. Andy Tadick is here as well. He manages the Atlanta dance and rap group We Are Tunes, and they created the popular dance, the Nay Nay. Hi, Andy.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
In case you don't recognize the Nay Nay, we're playing a little bit of it right now. I don't know how you could have missed it. So let's, Andy, first address how you invented the dance for the Nay Nay.
Well, I didn't quite invent it. I was more so on the business side. My group, We Are Tunes, actually invented the dance.
How did that process go?
Well, their process was they were doing a lot of talent shows around Atlanta and different high schools and stuff, and they were getting ready for a show. And in all their shows, they do skits where they interact with the crowd. And they were in a basement rehearsing, and they felt like, hey, we need something new, something different for the show. So they were in the basement just kind of making some moves, and they wanted to do a skit about your average fun girl at the club that was being extra.
Right.
And, you know, one of them started kind of moving side to side, and, you know, another one said, what does a girl in the club do? She always has her hand up. She's either pointing at somebody or, you know, she's seeking attention.
Yeah, saying woo. And,
right. So next thing you know, the hand goes up, and the Nay Nay was invented right there. There was no name for it at the time. It was supposed to be Shenanay, but the name, it just felt like it was too long and it wasn't ringing, and it got cut down to Nay Nay. And the videos, actually a viral video, one of the first videos that got posted was the first time they got like 300-400 likes on Instagram. And at that moment, they kind of knew, okay, something is going on, because they, you know, they're used to getting 30-40 likes. And,
yeah.
And that moment, it just literally, the dance spread. There was no song at the time. It was literally just
right,
the dance.
Right, the song came later after the dance went
absolutely
viral. So, Rodney, what you seem to have noticed, and this is something that our senior producer noticed as well, because we saw this video that actually, ironically, went viral from The New Yorker, in which it was supposed to be a history of viral dances in hip-hop. And all but two of those dances came out of the South, and a number of them from Atlanta. So you started looking into this, right? Why Georgia in particular would be a source for viral dances?
Yeah, I had the pleasure of... Well, when I was growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a similar dance craze in Atlanta. And it was called the Yeek. And this dance, we didn't have viral videos back then, but it was socially viral. You know, the talent shows, the teen clubs, everywhere you went, people were doing the Yeek, and there were dance crews that engaged in this dance all the time.
Let's hear a little bit. The song A-Town Get Down by Countrified Swag. This is included in the upcoming Yeek documentary, and in it you hear sort of the basic instructions on how to do the Yeek. Do the app, go crazy, feel the ladies. Cause you're crazy, baby. Now shoulder rock and glide. My shoulder rock so fine. Do the onion, y'all, to make the flavor raw. I make you switch your eyes and cry. Do the ground, go, get, go, hop, oh, knee, no, crisscross, to the right, stop, oh. Okay, so one of the first things they say in there is do the Alf. I would imagine there's not a lot of young people left who know who Alf was.
Right, right. There's also the Bart. You know, the Bart was a big dance back then. I mean, the Yeek was basically a four-step count dance. But within that, you would have different crews add different signature moves and that kind of thing. So anyway, I wanted to find somebody who was a member of an original Yeek crew, and I found this guy named Carlton McDuffie, who went by the name Kool-Aid back in the day. And he was part of a crew called Obsession. And he's kind of become a historian of sorts on the Yeek movement in terms of helping to curate and throw reunions featuring a lot of the older dancers. But he really had a really good insight in terms of how this dance and this culture kind of came about. And he really likens it to kind of like Atlanta's version of b-boying and breakdancing in New York hip hop. You know, it was kind of running along the same time, and it was just as kind of broad and culturally influential in terms of lifestyle and that kind of stuff.
Rennie, let me bring you into this. And how did dances go viral before the days of YouTube and social media?
Well, a lot of it had to do with just, you know, travel. Families like your cousin from maybe down south would come up north, or you would go down south or go to the West Coast. And you learn the dance from that area and then go back and, you know, you think that, oh, no, you guys don't know, you know, how to do this. This is new stuff from the other side, you know what I mean? So, and then these dances would become popular. Sometimes video, but not really. Back then it wasn't a lot of video, but we always looked for video. But mostly just traveling. You know, you go to a different hood, you go to a different within the city itself, there are different styles sometimes, or different ways, or different movements, that's popular on the north side of Philly, west where I'm from, or versus the south side of Philly.
Let me play you, Andy, a comment from Callie Marr from the group We Are Tunes. And we asked what the response was of the group after the dance went viral. So take a listen.
When we started going, like, super viral, we didn't know what to do. Like, we were like, we just got to keep making videos, see how far we can get it. It's really not even in our hands anymore. Like, it really just went out of control.
It's hard to hear what he says at the very beginning, but he says, when you started going super viral where we didn't know what to do, what was that like when suddenly you realized that a move you just, the group had just made up was being done all over the world?
Well, I think at that time, it's like when anytime something goes viral, you're playing catch up. Right. So it's very unexpected. You know, now, obviously, people plan for things to go viral, so they're a little more prepared. But with the Nene, it just nobody was prepared. I mean, you know, it was just four guys, or, you know, at that time it was like six kids in the basement having fun. You know, they ended up creating this move and they didn't know what to do. They didn't know the music business. They didn't know the business side. They didn't know really how to capitalize off of this. It started spreading like
wildfire. How to make money from a move they created.
Right. I mean, they knew, obviously, the popularity was everywhere. I mean, you know, they're waking up and their notifications and stuff is just going crazy, but they don't know what to do with it. So, you know, at that point, that's where we kind of stepped in, like, okay, let's start putting the pieces together because this is turning into something. And it was more so than just how do we brand it as a dance, but where's the music? You know, we need a song to kind of go with this.
So how do you make something like that actually marketable and have it make you money? Because we hear all the time about people not able to make any money off things that go viral on YouTube.
So for us, the reason we were able to capitalize was that's why we had to have a song come with it, right? So we came from the music side of selling records and moving music, you know, through record companies. So being the dance, it's very hard to capitalize off a dance. You could potentially be a dance group, per se, but not so much as in without music. So when we created the Nene song, that's we were able to sell it.
Okay, let's take a listen to that. Drop that Nene. Rennie, what are the components to a dance that goes viral, that becomes really popular? What's sort of the common elements?
Well, I think a lot of it is coming out of community, and that's the thing that everyone sort of relates to in general when we talk about street dances. Does that look like me? You know what I mean? So I think a lot of it has to do with it coming straight from the community. The other part to it is the music. You know, the music drives it a lot of times. So, and if that music is also coming out of community, and specifically in the South, like the South has been, you know, just dominating the airwaves, so to speak. And so it makes sense that that dance is going to follow that.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Rennie Harris, professor of hip-hop dance at UCLA and the University of Colorado in Boulder. Annie Tadic manages the Atlanta dance and rap group We Are Tunes. They created the dance The Nene. And Rodney Carmichael is senior staff writer at Creative Loafing and co-host of the 5 Points podcast. Rodney, what did you find about viral dance when you began looking into it? What were, especially the Yeek, but moving forward into some of the other dances people know really well, the Dougie, all the others that we see people doing, what do they have in common, and why do they come from the South?
Well, I think the interesting kind of through line is Southern swag. And this is another thing that Carlton McDuffie talked about when I got to talk to him. A lot of this stuff, his father was actually a drum major at Morris Brown College, and he kind of links all of this up into a lineage where he kind of sees, you know, skate culture, which influenced the Yeek in particular a lot, and black stepping, black fraternities and sororities in college, and stepping, you know, there's stepping moves and that kind of stuff. So he kind of links all that up together, but he really sees it as a continuation of this Southern swag that comes out of black urban culture that has always sort of defined the culture down here.
So, Rennie, then how does that translate? In order for something to go viral, it has to become popular with more than just young black people, right? How does a dance transcend its origins?
Well, I mean, you know, we're talking about hip hop in the 21st century. So, you know, and most people who are buying the music or downloading, you know, a lot of them are, you know, young white kids, you know, and that's been happening since NWA. So that's an easy transition when you, in regards to the music itself, and you want to be wherever the hip music is, and that's where, you know, that's hip hop. So you have a different audience. When you go to these rap concerts, most of the rap concerts are all white. You know, so it's just a different audience, and I think that and that makes it easier, especially then when you see yourself up there doing it, you see kids who are like yourself, that makes a lot of connection to you and say, oh, I can do that too. And so then it kind of goes and goes and goes, you know what I mean?
If you can do one of these popular dances, pick your favorite, the one that you do best. You can post a video at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might return the favor for you. It's our hashtag OST dance off. Andy, can you purposefully create a viral dance move?
Yeah, actually, you know, now we kind of figured out the formula, and, you know, me and my team, we can make something go viral. You know,
what's the formula? You're not going to share it. It's proprietary. It
costs money. No, no. You know, what you figure out is like, it's like tastemakers. Uh-huh. So some of the, you know, a lot of kids got fame, you know, Vine was a big influencer for the Nene. So Vine was like the big social media at that time, and a lot of kids.
Vine is the social media platform that allows you to post very short video.
Right. So in 2014, when we launched the Nene, Vine was like the big push for us. A lot of kids got Vine famous off doing stuff with the Nene. So for us, we were able to figure out who the tastemakers are, and you know, these kids just transition, so they go to the next popular social media app, and so forth, so forth. So, you know, when you kind of have a handful of the social tastemakers that have a great following, all you got to do is, it comes down to the content. If you give them something that's, the content is where anybody could duplicate it, you give it to them, it starts spreading. So at that point, it's just creating content. So, I mean, in all honesty, you need about 5 solid people with a decent following within that type of community
to create the video.
The rest goes viral.
Rodney, how does this feed into the conversation about cultural appropriation? Because we see artists of all colors and shades and genders doing these kind of viral dance videos. Do we consider that appropriation?
That's an interesting conversation. I think that one thing to consider is the fact that a lot of these crews that are creating these videos, a lot of times they don't really have ownership. Like, for instance, the Nene crew, they were able to monetize it because they did create a song to go with it. But when you're using these platforms, a lot of times the platforms themselves are the ones that are getting rich. And the record labels are the ones that are getting rich based off of whatever song the crews are dancing to, right? They become promotional tools, sometimes without the crews even realizing how the industry is benefiting from their cultural production. So it's an interesting conversation, you know.
But it sounds like it's still not quite settled.
Yeah, it's not. But there is definitely a money and production conversation that I think is an important piece that, you know, these crews don't always have the ability to take advantage of.
Randy, in the 30 seconds we have left, did you want to add to that on the discussion of appropriation?
Well, I mean, we're talking about appropriation. We're talking about the whole of African-American culture. So this is a continuum of what's always been done in regards to appropriating what comes out of the community of African-Americans.
Ronnie Carmichael is a senior staff writer at Creative Loafing. He's also co-host of the 5 Points podcast. You just heard Rennie Harris's voice, professor of hip-hop dance at UCLA and University of Colorado in Boulder. And Andy Taddock manages the Atlanta dance and rap group We Are Tunes. They created the popular dance, the Nene. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we want to hear what your favorite dance song is. We have our hashtag going, the OST Dance Off hashtag, and you can contribute to that with your moves. But is there a song that when it comes on, you have to move to it? Help us create the ultimate dance playlist. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day. Look at my down.